After she demands change, officials respond to the pleas of a Jacksonville activist. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and now never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Coming up in this hour, don't miss our conversation with local activist Denise Hunt on the fate of the troubled Eureka Garden Complex and more. Then later, we'll speak with Jacksonville author Michael Wiley about his new thriller set here on the First Coast, Second Skin. Plus, Cole Pepper on Florida's big win this weekend, plus the big winner in the World Series. Cole will join us with a look at sports, all of that ahead, and we will be welcoming Denise Hunt in just a little bit this morning. That's coming up this hour. Right now, though, Jacksonville author and UNF literature professor Michael Wiley. Wiley grew up in Chicago, actually, and some of his crime thrillers are set in the Windy City. But these days, Wiley is using the Jacksonville area as the setting for a new trio of stories. And this week, he's out with the latest in his Daniel Turner thriller series. Wiley is winning. Oh, wait a minute. Denise Hunt is here. So actually, Michael Wiley is going to be put on pause for just a moment as we welcome Denise Hunt to Studio 5. Last minute change. First this hour, federal inspectors say they're investigating the ministry that's running Jacksonville's troubled Section 8 housing complex, Eureka Garden. The Westside apartment community has long been plagued by high crime and deplorable living conditions. Now this new scrutiny is due in no small part to local activist Denise Hunt. Hunt successfully urged Mayor Lenny Curry and others to demand action. Hunt is a nurse. She's active on a number of community issues. She has a special needs son, and she joins us now in studio with her thoughts on the investigation and what she calls Jacksonville's Tale of Two Cities. Denise Hunt, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Ross. I'm happy to be here, and I appreciate you having me on.
And what are your questions for local community activist Denise Hunt when it comes to Eureka Garden? That's the Section 8 complex that's now the subject of a federal investigation. Get on the line now, 549-2900. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us. Let us know your thoughts. And so, Denise, you had been talking about the problems at Eureka Garden for some time, imploring Councilman Warren Jones to take action, imploring Mayor Curry to tour the complex. You were able to get him to do it. Since then, there's been a lot of movement. Now we're hearing there's going to be a deep dive by the feds. The CEO of Global Ministries, the Tennessee-based nonprofit that owns the complex, has really been put on the hot seat about the deplorable living conditions at Eureka Gardens. They could lose their ownership of this complex. So this morning, as you look at what's happened since you first raised the alarm, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are I'm very excited about the mayor. I'm grateful that the mayor went out and actually took my challenge. That was one of the things that, matter of fact, that was the only thing I asked him to do. As everybody knows, I'm a Republican. I make no qualms about that. But I did ask him, would he come and see about the people in Washington Heights and at the time Eureka Gardens, and I think it was Cleveland Arms also. And I saw him a couple of times and he said he would. So I'm very excited that the city is now stepping up to the plate, taking ownership of the problem, responsibility for the problem, and trying to fix the problem. So I'm grateful.
What would you like to see happen ultimately? Would you are you hopeful that there will be different ownership of this complex?
Well, I had the opportunity to meet with Reverend Hamlet on Thursday. And we sat down and we had a very, I would say, heated exchange in which, you know, we came to some understandings about what I expect to see. One of the things I am very adamant about, and I was shut down the other day in the meeting, was about some reimbursement for those tenants in terms of the $50 that was, I feel, taken unfairly from them for the air conditioning being placed by the landlord, the management team. I'm sorry, the management team.
Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, the management team out there was led by a lady named Holly, and evidently she had a husband that was working out there. He was not certified as a contractor, and he was putting in these air conditioning systems, but he was improperly putting them in. And consequently, the air conditioners were leaking water, and that water was leading to the mold and the mildew. And so I think those tenants should be reimbursed. Not only that, I think HUD has a responsibility in this. They passed it at an 85% pass rate, and they admitted that it was fragmentary and fraudulent in terms of the inspection that was done. And I think they have an obligation to maybe reimburse some monies there that was due. And that's what we do in America. We make things right first with money. And I think those tenants deserve some money. And I also think that they deserve the most egregious situations. Those children should be moved immediately.
Mm-hmm. And HUD Regional Administrator Ed Jennings saying that Global Ministries must provide an improvement plan, repair violations within a month, or lose their federal housing assistance funding. If the agreement is abated, according to the Times Union report, HUD will then provide vouchers for residents to go into the market to find other housing. Your thoughts?
I'm waiting to see if that's going to happen. The truth of the matter is, from my understanding, I don't think Mr. Hamlet has the capital to do what is needed to be done out there. After talking to him, I don't think he does.
Now, you said there was a heated exchange between you and him. What was said?
Well, basically, I let him know, you know, that I was very upset. I was very upset about those children. You know, as a nurse, breathing is fundamental. I'm an ER nurse, so the first thing I'm concerned about is whether a child can breathe. And I was very upset about that. I'm also upset about the monies that, like I said, was taken. I think he has an ethical obligation. We talked about his Christian responsibility.
And you don't think he's a good Christian?
I think he's a misguided Christian. He said that his things were that, you know, he was about the ministry. And like I let him know, I'll be going on the one of the things I'm going to be doing is reaching out to Pat Robinson in the 700 Club to let him know what's going on with Eureka Gardens. And I'm hoping that I'll be flying up to Virginia to talk about that.
Why Pat Robertson?
Because they're all in it together. They're all evangelical ministers and Christians, and I think they should all be held accountable if that's what they're saying they are. So, you know, put the whole Christian community in this.
We'll go to your calls for local activist Denise Hunt in just a moment at 549-2937. You know, earlier this year, you wrote a letter to the editor that was published in the TU, a letter titled Jacksonville is a Tale of Two Cities. I'm going to read from it a little bit. You wrote, I am a black woman, and I feel I have no power to influence or change any institution here in Jacksonville. According to the rules of our society, I'm part of the lowest order on the social hierarchy. Therefore, the only thing I can do is resist and challenge the status quo by speaking out, becoming engaged, protesting, and redirecting my dollars toward businesses that accommodate me. It must take corrective action to make opportunities accessible for everyone, to provide an even playing field. Any person who wants to achieve the American dream should be given a fair chance to thrive and become successful. The city should sponsor therapeutic dialogue to deal with issues of race, sexism, and class. And you go on to say that sometimes I feel hopeful, other times I feel utter despair. To paraphrase Charles Dickens, Jacksonville is a tale of two cities. Can you tell me what motivated you to write that letter to the editor?
Well, I was on the Times Union interactive email page, and I was being bombarded with a bunch of, racialized comments that were very hurtful. And just, I was just being, like I said, it was just outrageous, some of the things that were being said to me.
Like what?
Do you really want to know what I was called on there? I was called everything but a child of God. You know, I was called the N-word. I should go back to Africa. You know, all manner of things. I didn't have a right to be in America. You know, I was, you know, just all, I mean, just the whole slew of things. And I was just really shocked being a native of this city and the way I love Jacksonville. My whole family has been part of this city and its growth. starting with La Villa. My grandmother and uncle used to own where FSCJ is now. And so my whole family has had businesses here. One of my cousins was able to start a McDonald's. She owned all the McDonald's down in Gainesville from the business that my uncle started right on the north side. So I have a deep love for this city, for the north side, where I'm from. And I was just feeling very hurt. I was feeling very just angry. One of the things that changed my life, and I'm sitting over here looking at him, was my teacher from UNF, Dr. Michael Wiley. I got a chance, it really changed my life going to UNF, majoring in English and African American Diaspora Studies. And after I learned about, they taught me a lot of things about injustice and oppression. And I learned from William Blake about oppression from Michael Wiley. And I think those things changed my life and the way I saw the social hierarchy. I'd never heard those terms until I went to UNF. So when I came out of UNF, the whole thing was about applying the things that you learned, the activism, and that's what prompted me to really write that.
Since writing that letter, you have made a number of moves that have had an impact. Do you still feel powerless? Because of your actions, Denise, there is now an ongoing federal investigation into this complex that for years has been the scourge of this city, frankly. To reference Charles Dickens, Dickensian conditions. And now we must really give credit to you for bringing about what many say is a long overdue reckoning at Eureka Gardens.
Well, I don't want to take all of the recognition for what happened in Eureka Gardens. I think it was a collective voice. I think I was just at the right time, at the right place. I think God sent me out there. The first thing I went was to Washington Heights, as you know. I think that God just used me in the right place, and I'm just happy that my voice was effective. Do I still feel powerless in the city? A lot of times I do. There's a lot of things that's going around right now that I'm very outraged about, and I feel like I have no power to really change it. But I tell you one thing, I will continue to use my life. I've been privileged with a great education, starting with the Bowles High School, University of Florida, FSCJ, and now UNF. And I will use that education. I will use my voice to make a difference, and I will never stop.
And we're going to go to your calls right now for local activist Denise Hunt and your tweets and emails. 549-2937. Steve in Jacksonville. Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I applaud you for having your guest on. And number one, I applaud you for your bringing yourself up and getting an education and being a model citizen for Duval County. And I just want to say, I have a comment and a question. I said, as a taxpayer, I feel like that if we're investing the dollars and through HUD, that anybody that is a given HUD deserves the letter of the law. And whatever the rules are, to me, it wouldn't matter if the church owned it, the mafia owned it, if the city of Jacksonville owned it, if whoever owns it, doesn't matter. The rules are if the property should be in this condition, it should be in this condition. And I'm with that 100%. I heard you earlier, Melissa, comment about havens of crime. So let's take responsibility for this group has got to bring this place up to standard. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. We're paying for it. They deserve it. And they're going to get it. I have a specific question. What responsibility in relationship to crime do you think the tenants of that property have in taking a role in saying, yes, we're going to allow drugs to go on. Yes, we're going to allow prostitution to go on. Yes, we're going to allow murder to go on. We're not going to say a word. We're not going to point fingers. We're not going to point these drug dealers out. We're going to let this prostitution take place. We're going to let these drug deals take place. Or do you feel like that that's not any of the tenants' responsibility and that we're going to shrug that off and we're going to say, No, we're not going to point fingers. We're not going to tell who the drug dealers are. We're not going to say where prostitution's going on. I would love to take your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Denise.
Well, you know, when you look at, you mentioned specifically prostitution, but prostitution breeds from what? Economic lack. And so when you look at the crime, my whole thing is that I think that once we start to address some of the poverty issues out there in terms of lack of jobs, lack of opportunity, lack of hopelessness, some of the, I mean, if you had to live in those conditions every single day of your life, is no telling what you may resort to. Do I think the tenants have a responsibility to point out crime and other issues? Of course they do. And they have been doing that. A lot of the tenants are afraid to speak up because there's been some intimidation issues out there. And what I would
like
love
what? Can you explain?
Well, the And I have to be very careful what I say because I don't want to be charged with any kind of libel or slander. But from what I've understood, some of the tenants feel like some of the drug issues, some of the crime issues are related to some of the things that's going on with the management. So I don't want, I'm speculating, I guess, you know, from what I've heard them say, but I can't verify that. But the point is, of course, there's crime out there. There's crime in this whole city. I'm concerned about the whole city. And as far as Eureka Gardens and the crime in the tenants, of course, they have a responsibility to speak up. But I would welcome you, Mr. Wise, to come out to Eureka Gardens, take a walk through there with me, and you will see that the crime is not really as prevalent as I think the city is trying to make it be. The tenants are taking responsibility. They have formed associations, and they are very much involved. And now that we are working on solving these issues, these housing issues, I think you're going to see crime come down out there.
Let's go to Shay in Orange Park. Hi, Shay. Good morning.
Good morning. First, I'd like to thank you, Michelle, for having such a wonderful platform to allow Jacksonvillians and anyone in the surrounding areas to be able to be informed as well as to express our viewpoints. Next, I would like to thank Denise for being such an amazing bright light in what tends to be at times a very dark atmosphere. I'm a native Floridian. I'm originally from South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, and I was educated in Tallahassee. And when I moved here, I really was under the impression that I was moving to a large city. And what I found was that I was living in a large town. There are a lot of issues here in Jacksonville that Ms. Hunt has spoken of that are true. They're prevalent. When I went on the north side for the first time, my mouth is literally agape. It is not that we don't have pockets of poverty in Fort Lauderdale. We do. But what I did notice is that some areas, especially during the, I think it was called the Better Jacksonville Plan, when I first moved here in 2000, where a lot of monies were being placed into the city, but no money was really going into the impoverished areas in North Jacksonville. So what I would say to the previous caller is, that, you know, there is responsibility to go around. When you have government officials coming out to this property and passing them with 85% tile of you know, that they're basically being told that what they're doing is okay, that's a problem. There's responsibility there. You have the owners. That's a problem. You have people that live in complexes that are creating crimes. The management could have had the police to come in. They know what's going on. It just seems to me as though people really don't care until it affects them directly. And that is a huge problem, not only in this city, mm-hmm. but in our country.
All right. So thanks, Shay. Yeah. Thank you, Shay. Denise, a minute ago you said that so many things outrage you in this city. Does that comport with what Shay is talking
about? Oh, absolutely. And when you look at Eureka Gardens, I'm upset that the fact that those children, see, I always focus on the children, I guess, because I'm currently serving as a pediatric nurse, so I got a tenderness for children. You look at Hyde Park Elementary, those children are going to F-rated public schools right across the street. Wayman Academies, that school has 100 kids in a charter school that's D-rated. I'm concerned about the education that's around there, that these children are being afforded. It's as though they have no outs. I'm just concerned. I'm outraged about just so much. But the poverty, the issues, not just for black people, but for whites. As a nurse, I've been in these homes and did case management. And I'm telling you, these rural areas of Jacksonville, you know, when you go in Clay County and some of the other areas, they're hurting too. And I mean, It's a situation that nobody wants to talk about, but the poverty in Jacksonville in the outlying districts is just deplorable.
And what would, in your view, what's the solution?
Well, the solution is a responsive government, and the solution is actually taking the dollars that are earmarked for these areas and really applying it to programs that really work. Most of those programs, Melissa, believe it or not, most of that money is going to administrative fees and it's not hitting the people that is supposed to be getting the monies. I've seen that over and over. I'm disgusted with it. There's just so much. I mean, we could just go on and on. But the crime, in terms of the crime, I'm just really upset about how Jacksonville, the north side, is being impeded with mass incarceration, the juvenile justice rates. You know, the Fourth Judicial Circuit has the highest incarceration rates of black juveniles of anybody. It's just so much in the city, and the city is hurting, and the whole soul of the city is hurting. And I'm just asking God, I'm asking the people to come together and just try to find some common solutions and find some heart to help our city grow. We're at a pivotal point in our city's history. And if we do not take responsibility for some of the things that's going on and stop trying to blame each other, but trying to find common core solutions, our city is headed for a nightmare.
Lots of calls for community activist Denise Hunt. Eric is downtown. Hello, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a little confused. I don't see how the person that wrote that letter to the editor could at the same time be a member of a political party that opposes raising the minimum wage, that opposes health insurance for the working poor, and whose only goal seems to be to incarcerate as many poor people as possible, and while at the same time lowering a tax burden on the extremely wealthy. I'm really confused about your party affiliation. Thank you.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, that's fair, and I can take that. There's a lot. When I was, by the way, I was a member of the Democratic Party for years. Matter of fact, I grew up, and it was against the law to be not a Democrat on the north side. I became
against the law.
Yeah, it was against the law to live on the north side and not be a Democrat. But I got frustrated with a lot of things that the Democrats were doing in the city. I didn't see the unity. I didn't see where people were actually being getting the help. At the time when I did join the Republican Party, they were about some of the things that I was about, which was economic uplift. Since then, I went to UNF, and I kind of got a different perspective. But I'm going to stay a part of the Republican Party because I think I bring a breath of fresh light to the Republican Party. I think I bring the common sense back. I think I attack the absurd in the party. I think I'm needed in the party to keep them from becoming obsolete. If everybody that has the knowledge leave the Republican Party and turn it over to the absurd and the irresponsible, who's going to bring the issues like Eureka Garden to them? Who would have brought you, Lenny Curry, out there? Who would have bought Sam Newby? The other guy from Dole Carter. Who can speak to them better than an African-American woman that grew up on the north side that understand and has lived both cities?
Are you going to run for office?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Why not?
I don't think I'd be elected. I don't think anybody would.
Why wouldn't you be? I'm going to read you a few tweets. Listening to community activist Denise Hunt right now. Wow. Speaking truth to power. Thank you for giving this guest an opportunity to speak her truth and discuss injustice. I am loving this guest. I just tuned in. Please tell me her name. She is an awesome child of God. Here's another one. I think there needs to be more emphasis and explanation on how HUD gave Eureka Gardens this 85% rating. And here's one from Sandy. What was the catalyst that finally got this issue much needed attention and action? Well, actually, it was you, Denise, and your full name is Denise Hunt.
Right. Well, actually, I think, you know, God sent you to, you never know how God is going to use you. And I got a message from a young lady named Ramonda Fields, and she said, Denise, I need you to come out. You've been out in Washington Heights, and actually I was responding to Alvin Brown, who said he'd made a difference in Washington Heights, and I went out there to see whether he really had made a difference. And when I got out there, I found out that he had told a lie. Straight up, I'm going to tell it like it is right now. So they knew that I had a pension for the people living in these complexes, and I did a video featuring, I think her name was Mona Lisa Arnold, and I let her tell her story. Because one thing I learned at UNF, that narratives are important, and to let people just tell their stories. And I went out there and we shot a video. Well, that video went around the city. So, you know, I think that helped. I think when you just have the courage to do what is right and to live your principles, and my principles is Christ-centered, and I just try to apply it. And it just takes courage.
Julie is in Atlantic Beach. Hello, Julie.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Denise, you are saying so many things that I agree with. And I called actually a few weeks ago, Melissa, you had on A.J. Garganti and some other people to discuss like how these things can't happen in isolation. And so, Denise, I wanted you to speak to education, poverty, and charter schools. You had the outstanding benefit of going to a school like Bowles. I came to Jacksonville 4 years ago and was surprised at the privatized education here in Jacksonville. And it's continuing, and the privatized education, both charter schools, all that, separates our community. And it's a power divide. And I'm not sure how kids in Eureka Gardens with charter schools who are for-profit or whatever, and then dealing with the people in power who probably went up through the private schools, are in fact going to be able to really overcome the obstacles. Like, in my opinion, that's institutionalized racism with all the privatization of these schools. And I'm a believer that there should be no charter schools and no private schools. So can you speak to that as how we can, you know, how that can help get us out of the, us as a being a collective Jacksonville, out of the mess that we're in right now? And thank you again. I'll go off the air now.
Well, I'm very grateful for my Bowles school education. My mother cleaned toilets to send me there. And I have an obligation to really live up to what she would want to see happen. And I was afforded that opportunity. And it was a privilege. Make no mistake about it. When we look at matter of fact, let me just share this with you. Reverend Hamlet from Global Ministries pointed out to me that Wayman Academy is across the street was a D-rated school. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. And he made some archaic remark about the tides that rise, we must help them, you know, because I was like, well, why are you, you know, you're working with the pastor across the street and everything. He said, well, yeah, we're going to have to help them too. So I'm not about to get involved in something that I feel is wrong. That D-rated school needs to be dealt with. I mean, they're making money off these people, and I'm just not for it. And I think that as far as magnet schools or charter schools, I'm all for entrepreneurship, but not at expense of poor people, and especially if they're not delivering what they're being paid for. So I'm all for big business, small business, all of that good stuff, but not when it is unfettered greed.
One more tweet coming into the show from Josh. Denise Hunt is just the kind of political outsider and experienced community organizer Jacksonville needs. So you're winning raves on social media this morning, FYI. Are you on Twitter, by the way? I'll have to look.
I think my daughter has me on Twitter, but I don't really know how to use the Twitter. I'm kind of new to Facebook. But
you might want to get on there because they definitely know about you now. And I do hope that you will keep us posted on what happens as we follow this story. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. And I appreciate you giving me this opportunity and this platform. And I'd love for you to come out to Eureka Gardens and take a walk through. I'm asking everybody. I'm asking everybody in Jacksonville, my teacher that's sitting here, come out and see the people and connect with the people. And once you connect, then you can never turn back.
That's
you
right. Can. Well, the film I produced some years ago, The 904, we shot quite a few scenes at Eureka Garden and in Washington Heights. Yes, I agree with you. People should see it. And I appreciate you being here, Denise. Hope to see you again soon.
Yes. Just keep in mind, Melissa, that this is a bigger problem than just Eureka Gardens. This is a national problem with substandard housing.
Denise Hunt joining us morning.
Thank you.
Local author Michael Wiley is up next. We'll talk about his hot new thriller, Second Skin, and Culpepper as well. Keep listening.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to present Michael Feldman's What Do You Know Live. That's right, I'm bringing my show to Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy a little bit of a break from the Wisconsin winter. So, do your holiday shopping earlier, surprise your Valentine next February. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Richard Holbrooke was a superstar diplomat, handling this country's most difficult international problems. Now, his son, a filmmaker, tells his father's story.
People wanted to talk about him. They were intrigued by him. He was left an indelible mark on everybody that he touched.
The documentary film, The Diplomat, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville author and UNF literature professor Michael Wiley grew up in Chicago, and some of his crime thrillers are set in the Windy City. But these days, Wiley is using this area as the setting for a new trio of stories. This week, he's out with the latest in his Daniel Turner series, and Wiley is winning raves with Second Skin, an action-packed murder mystery set here on the First Coast. Kirkus Reviews calls Second Skin powerfully unnerving. Publishers Weekly writes, Wiley is extremely good at creating an atmosphere of menacing dread. New shocks occur all the way to the last page. With more about the story and the setting, we speak with the author right now. Michael Wiley, welcome back to Studio 5.
Thanks, Melissa. Great to be here.
I love your books. I'm a Chicago girl, of course. I loved your Joe Kosmarski private detective series. I loved that character, all the Chicago scenes. But you've decided now to write some books set in this area, which is also really cool because you live here now.
I'm here. I've been here for 18 years.
Yeah, so why not write about this area?
That's right.
So tell us about Second Skin.
Second Skin, the title really refers to the way that everybody has double identities or more than double identities. You know, we put on the faces to meet the faces that we meet. We have biological identities. We claim identities for ourselves, whether political party or anything else. And then there are the identities that are imposed on us through circumstances. And so in this story, there's a young woman, a 19-year-old woman who's a student. who gets murdered. And in a lot of ways, the whole mystery is trying to seek through those identities and to figure out who she is. And of course, everybody who is seeking for her identity and to figure out what happened to her also has those doublenesses.
And the narration goes back and forth between a husband and a wife. That's an interesting concept, an interesting literary conceit. How does that affect the story?
The wife is a literature professor. She teaches American literature, and she's big into Emily Dickinson, who she sees as a very dark, noir kind of a poet, not something that Emily Dickinson is usually given credit for being. And her husband is back from his work on a ship where he's been processing the bodies of people who've been killed in Afghanistan. So he's in the Navy, and he's back, and he's traumatized by that. And so his new job is as a skip tracer, somebody who is locating people who have gone missing, usually for businesses, but sometimes for families who are concerned about their loved ones. And so when this woman, Lillian Turner, when her student goes missing, she comes home to her husband, Johnny Belfleur, and asks him if he will take a look into this. And that's how the whole story gets started.
And there's a real sense of place. You describe local neighborhoods in Jacksonville, Amelia Island, all over this area. That had to have been fun for you as well.
I love it. You know, this is the Sunshine State, and I like to say that I write about the dark side of the Sunshine State. And, you know, it's the kind of city that deserves books to be written about it. I think we forget about that, or sometimes we don't look into those corners, look into the shadows as much as we might. And I've found this to be just as rich of a landscape as, say, Chicago. I lived in New York for a long time, where lots of people write about New York, lots of people write about Chicago. But Northeast Florida, everything from the wetlands to the urban streets, the north side, the south side, the beaches, Amelia Island, you know, go down to St. Augustine, and we just have a really rich and varied landscape.
You're becoming, in a way, sort of this area's crime writer. You're giving Jacksonville a voice. You're giving this area a sense of place through literature.
I hope, you know, this would be my high goal. This would be my high goal. This strikes me as a place that hasn't been written about a lot, and it deserves to be written about a lot. Now, you know, the writing about crime doesn't necessarily make this out to be the prettiest place, but the places that I love the most, the places that have the kind of rich, the complexity that really interests me and want me to see and visit and dig into the place more fully, are those places where there's the brightness and the darkness, and they all come together. So that's the goal, is to write about this place.
You've been writing for a long time, too, and with this book, Second Skin, there's really been a breakthrough. Now, this is the second in a trio of books. Blue Avenue came first, now Second Skin, and then there's going to be a third. This is a series. So.
Right. The third will be Black Hammock, and that's going to be coming out next summer in the U.S., this one, Second Skin, is just out this week, which is exciting for me. And they're all called the Daniel Turner thrillers. And Daniel Turner is a homicide detective. His sister, Lillian Turner, that's the wife who takes part in this narrative. And really, though, the hero, really the kind of central figure, is the city, because each of these books has a different narrator. Each of the books has a different protagonist. Each of the books has a different set of crimes. Daniel Turner always figures in. He makes the arrest, if arrest occurs.
Yeah.
And yet, it's really about this city.
Jacksonville's its own character.
It is. And that's something that one sees often in crime writing, is cities and places, that they have a kind of a character of their own.
If you had to describe Jacksonville as a character, if you had to give it an adjective, what adjective would you give it?
Oh, I don't think that I would just give a single adjective. You know, I'd say it's really that kind of combination of contradictions and contraries. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of a bright grittiness or a dirty tropics, you know, all of those kinds of things. You know, we're not South Florida. We're anything other
it's
than
neither
say,
fish nor fowl.
That's right. But it's both. Yeah. You know, I think it's both fish and fowl, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. And so the other thing, too, about your books that I like is here you are. You're a literature professor. You're an academic. I mean, I'm really kind of actually kind of surprised you don't have little patches on your on your jacket there. Like, you really fit the part. You look like a professor. But you write these cops. You write the cops so well. How do you know you're really good at writing cops? Did you grow up in a family of cops? Like, how do you know them so well?
You know, I didn't. In fact, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. I lived downtown a lot of years as well. But the years when I was there, you know, kind of the most interesting things that were going on when I was a kid were really the kids who were breaking the rules. And so from very early on, I took an interest in this. From very early on, I was reading and following crime. And so after a certain amount of time, one kind of picks up on it. And I've done the research. And so I've ridden with the homicide detectives. I've spent time on patrols. I've gone and I've talked with people. I've, you know, known plenty of the people who are involved in both sides of these stories, whether breaking the rules and committing the crimes or solving them.
And you give these characters, especially the police detectives, I think, you show all their humanity, at their flawed people, but you really give them a sort of honor. And they have their own code. They have their own values. They have their own system, their own closed world. And you really get inside that world and you honor that world in your own way. And I really enjoy reading about it.
That's high praise. Thank you. Yeah. The people who are doing this work, you know, I have
it's such tough work.
Very, very tough work. You know, and these are people, you know, just like the, you know, anybody else in these stories, they're complex people and they have complex lives and they will make mistakes and they will sometimes do the bad thing, whether intentionally or accidentally. And that strikes me not as a criticism necessarily, you know, it can be, of course, but it's not necessarily a criticism so much as a description of what it means to be a person. And of course, these are people who are in very tough situations, as are a lot of the others who are committing the crimes here.
Well, it's Second Skin, the latest in author Michael Wiley's Daniel Turner series. It's a thriller set here on the First Coast, winning rave reviews. Pick it up now. It's on sale, of course, in all the usual places and hopefully some local independent bookstores.
I think so. In fact, if anybody wants to come down to Chamberlain's Uptown on Friday between 5 and 7, we'll be holding a release party and serving wine and signing books.
Yes. Yeah, so support your local bookstore. Come meet author Michael Wiley Friday night at Chamberlain's Uptown. It's the new one, Second Skin, out this week. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Well, coming up, Gator fans happy after this weekend's big game in the sports complex. Culpepper's up next.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Ileana Douglas describes how her life was forever changed when her dad started a commune in the backyard after seeing the film Easy Rider, starring Dennis Hopper.
He started to grow his hair longer. He started to grow a mustache. I mean, he started to resemble Dennis Hopper.
Douglas has a new memoir called I Blame Dennis Hopper. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union present the 13th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used men, women, and children's sweaters, jackets, socks, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union locations and Two Men in a Truck at 8849 Arlington Expressway. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
I'm going to say something and see what you think. Here goes. There is too much TV out there.
What I'm saying is that mediocre and good gets in the way of great when we don't have a good system for identifying and promoting great.
I'm Kai Rizdal. One man's theory about the television content bubble next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, turning point in the Florida-Georgia game.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
With more on that and the World Series and how it relates to the Jaguars, here's Cole Pepper this morning. Hey, Cole, and you're a happy man today.
I am, as a long-suffering and lifelong Kansas City Royals fan. Life is good.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. We'll get to that in just a second. Let's talk about Florida-Georgia, though, which, and the reason I call it a turning point, Melissa, is because I think what we've seen here is a kind of divergence of the directions of two programs, Florida and Georgia. This was supposed to be the year, with everybody else kind of down in the SEC East, that Georgia could storm through with a great running game and perhaps challenge an Alabama or an Auburn in the SEC championship game. And Mark Richt needs to have that kind of a season, because he's been a very good coach for Georgia, but they haven't won the big one. Now,
right,
as Bobby Bowden once told me, the big one is always the one you don't win, according to the naysayers, right? But he has never won a national championship. He has won some SEC titles, but has never gotten the big one. So this was supposed to be that year. A couple things happened along the way. First, terrible injury to Nick Chubb, the best player for Georgia. Knee injury a couple of weeks ago took him out. He was a Heisman candidate, great running back, and it really changed what they could do. Two, they didn't really develop a quarterback the way they expected to. And third, and maybe most significantly, Jim McElwain came to Florida and suddenly turns things around for the Gators on the short track. I mean, a lot of times you see, a team that's been bad for 3 or 4 years, 1 year that they're competitive, and then maybe the next year they contend, or the following year they contend.
Uh-huh.
That's not what Jim McElwain has done in Florida. He's turned them around in 1 year and suddenly made Florida the team to beat in the SEC East. Again, it's helped that South Carolina has been down, Tennessee's just okay, and Florida escaped with a miraculous victory over Tennessee to help their season. But in the SEC East, that's basically down. This was the game that was going to determine who was going to be the SEC East champion. Now, Florida has the inside track on it, thanks to their performance on Saturday here in Jacksonville. And it's going to be interesting to see what kind of reaction this has. Already, you've got Georgia fans who have a high expectation of what their program is going to do. Some calling for Mark Richt's job, others saying, well, let's just see how it all plays out. Nobody right now really is saying, no, we're fine, everything's just fine.
Right.
So I think this, from that regard, it is a turning point as far as the rivalry is concerned, because I think Florida's got their guy going forward. They feel very good about the hire they've made. Georgia right now doesn't know what direction they're heading in.
Interesting. Well, the game aside and all of the machinations, a beautiful weekend in the sports complex.
Oh, it was fantastic. Now the fair, and then they'll commence the hosing down of the sports complex. So when everything wraps up, there's a lot that's been going on down there. Enormous crowds, as always. A lot of folks coming to Jacksonville, some of whom actually made it into the stadium, although I think somebody made the point that at kickoff, there were a lot of empty seats that folks maybe were waking up and rallying from the parking lot festivities to get back in somewhere in the first quarter.
Yes, waking up a little late. And then the RV city, of course, all around this building, as it always is.
Yes,
so
as I drove in, I saw a super long trailer hauling away the porta potties, so we know that Florida Georgia weekend is coming to a close.
Coming to a close, and the World Series over. And as you said, you must have been just thrilled to the gills.
I was, yeah. And the Royals, and here's how it relates to the Jaguars. The Royals went from basically 1997 to 2012 without a winning record.
That's a long dry spell, Cole Pepper.
Yes, it is. That's a decade and a half without a winning record. And now you think of the Jaguars, and you think, well, they haven't been in the playoffs since 2007.
Yeah.
It's not quite that long.
Yeah.
But the point of this is that they turned it around, and while it's two different sports and the comparison is not necessarily apples to apples, here's how the Royals turned it around. And I think here's what that point is as far as the Jaguars. They found they really dedicated to three things. One is developing their own talent, which in NFL parlance means draft and develop.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, they put a lot into scouting other teams to be able to understand, to be better prepared than anybody else was, heading in. And number three, when they brought players together, they brought players together with a certain character and personality type that would buy in to not only what the coaches were saying, the manager, Ned Yost, but also to buy into each other. And a lot of these guys, and you can't do this in football in the same exactly the same way, came up through the ranks, A-ball, double-A, triple-A, the big leagues, all together. So it's guys who have spent a lot of time building that teamwork together. And that's one of the things I think Jaguars fans can look at and say, it's if you can mimic that kind of approach, you can turn things around even after a long, long dry spell.
Sure. Well, let's hope so. But in the meantime, congrats, Cole.
Thank you.
I know it's exciting. And last but not least, the Armada wrapping up their inaugural season
this weekend. I think the last game yesterday was a microcosm of the season. Very competitive. They lose 1-0 to Fort Lauderdale, a team that is going to the playoffs now. And you saw a lot of that. But also over 9,000 at Community First Park at the baseball grounds, a record for a soccer game at that facility. They started the season with the preseason NASL attendance record, started the regular season with a regular season attendance record playing at Everbank Field, and then finished the year with their best attendance at Community First Park.
Yeah.
The support has been fantastic. Now the lesson is, get better on the field for
next year.
That's
right. Let's hope so. But wow, what a sports weekend. You must have just been like a pig in slop with all of this stuff going on.
Yes, and I'll be a pig in slop needing a nap for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, well, yeah. Enjoy a little downtime. And thank you for being here as always.
Thank you.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Michelle Corum running the board today, though, for us. The show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. And never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, the White House plans to send a contingent of special forces to Syria, the first sustained American ground presence there. Diane and her guests examine what the new deployment means for U.S. involvement in the region and the fight against ISIS. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
Baptist Health's AIDWELL Center presents There's No Place Like Home, Saturday, November 21st at UNF. This day-long conference on aging features keynote speaker Tipa Snow, one of America's leading dementia educators, and is designed for anyone who cares for an older adult. Register at carepartners.eventbrite.com.